Yeah, 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 come and take a look at the snow. Bright white as far as your eyesight goes. Come and take a look at the fields of snow. I'll just get my coat, then we're good to go. Come and take a look at the lake. Let's have a quick skate before it gets late. Come and take a look at the frozen lake. Put your clothes on, mate, don't make that mistake.
Greetings, holiday shoppers. There are now 208 shopping days left until Christmas, and you know what that means. It means it's time for another episode of Christmas Creeps, your one-stop shop for holiday movies and TV shows all year round. My name is Joseph Wade. I'll be your host for this evening. Here with me tonight are my co-hosts, Johnny Five, the human robot.
Hello.
Hello, John. How are you today?
Ah, shitty. How are you?
I'm the exact same. And Mr. Bradford is here. Brad.
Zoom. Enhance.
180 degrees. Render.
Don't get me nice. Started.
I'll give them this. If any assholes would have the ability to fucking do that, it'd be them assholes. Like,
I suppose.
Like, it's not some random dipshit with a fucking MacBook hacking into an alien spaceship. It actually makes sense for those are the assholes that would have the technology. I'll say that.
If anybody could theoretically render the back half of Gene Hackman's head, yeah, I guess it's Pixar, right? Like, the high-end, high-tech machinery of, you know, the U.S. government is the best we can do. Hi, folks. Welcome to our Memorial Day episode, folks. Summer is finally upon us, and we thought it would be fun for us to spend this summer discussing all kinds of holiday action movies. Why not, right? Like, it's a genre that we've dipped into before, but there's a whole lot more, and I guarantee you it will be worse than the film we cover tonight, which is the 1998 Tony Scott directed Enemy of the State. Gentle friends, first impressions, please.
It was pretty funny. The woman in the nurse costume was pretty hot. And it was funny when all them dudes were naked.
Did you watch the same movie as... Oh, wait, no. I remember that now.
Yeah, it was about 2 or 3 minutes long. Had a nice soundtrack, too.
Oh, no, John, I think you are woefully... you're woefully far afield tonight. I think you may have just watched a Blink-182 video.
Tony Scott still did a pretty good, damn good job on it, you know?
John, this is about the time I'm going to walk away from this podcast. I'm done here.
Deal. Aww. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Da, da, da,
da, da. No.
Can't start a new podcast, Music Vidiots.
He's been planning this for years, folks. No, Bradford, tell us.
Put tell a guy us on something, the spot, wouldn't huh? you? Yeah. I didn't hate it. It was fun. It's certainly a departure from what we usually watch, which I think is a welcome respite. What is there to say? It's a dumb, schlocky action thriller movie from the late 90s that is kind of ahead of its time in that it predicted the sort of Homeland Security surveillance complex that is our modern day life, I suppose.
I think the biggest shocker to me watching this today was that at no point did any of the surveillance stuff shock or frighten me, because like, yeah, that sounds about right. That's par for the course these days.
Let's put it this way. Of the technology displayed in the movie, some of it is a little far-fetched, but none of it is particularly outlandish. You know what I'm trying to say, I guess?
Yeah.
Like, obviously, they can't just fly satellites over for constant view or render the back of a man's head without... I mean, now in the days of machine learning, I suppose you could probably do that. But back in the late 90s...
Yeah, back in the late 90s, when there wasn't a phone with a camera in literally every hand that walked the face of the earth... coming up with surveillance footage was a little bit more difficult than it is today.
But yeah, same page, different playbook, I guess you should say.
Essentially. So, I mean, it's enough to just drive me to drink, which, you know, fortunately, I have one ready to go.
Can check.
I have a bottle this week. I am drinking a Leinenkugel Summer Shandy because this is the summer movie season, after all.
This is
my go-to brew for the hotness of summer.
It is culturally summer now that we're through Memorial Day.
We are well and truly in the midst of barbecue season.
The pools are open. It's time to...
And the powder is bitching.
Yes, correct.
I was almost there.
Oh.
You got me. Anybody else have a frosty brew this evening?
Of course I do. I'm keeping it hyper-local this week. I've got a Caboose Fog Hazy IPA. 7% ABV, 42 IBUs. Not bad. Pretty good.
Not bad at all.
Oh. Yeah, that's good. It's got kind of got a grapefruit situation going on. I'm not mad.
I can always get behind a good fruit flavored beer.
Yes.
I mean, heck, I'm drinking half lemonade right now anyways.
As one is wont to do.
But J-Man, anything over there?
Yeah, like Brad, I'm keeping it local, like really hyper local. I'm drinking bathtub gin. Made it myself.
Are you in the bathtub?
No, that's where the fucking gin is. Good God.
Well, you're going to have to drink a lot of it because apparently there's a storm headed our way.
I mean, I came prepared.
You know what they say, when a storm is coming and you anticipate you're going to lose power, you fill up the bathtub with gin.
No, honor our fallen mafia guy in the movie, I forget what his name is, I have a San Pellegrino.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Grazie.
Keeping it cento.
Vaffanculo.
What the hell is wrong with us, guys?
Our friends say we should act our age.
Anyways, so Enemy of the State, this opens up, we get the Touchstone Pictures logo. That's right, kids, we have a DFD on our hands. Disney for Dads. This is a designated Disney for Dads situation we got going on here. So the instigating incident of this movie is that a congressman is murdered by the NSA. The NSA chief, played by John Voight, wants a certain congressman to vote for the Telecommunications Security and Privacy Act. And he says, absolutely not. No way. So John Voight tells Special Agent Barry Pepper to fucking murder this guy. However, there's a wrinkle in the situation because, as we later find out, a nature photographer played by Jason Lee has been videotaping the entire thing by accident.
Yeah, what the fuck is wrong with this movie's cast?
Oh, it gets worse. But go on, please.
It's just like, hey, every dude who was in Can't Hardly Wait, I got a movie for you now. That's basically what it was.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, it's every young that guy actor in the late 90s shows up in this movie in one way or another.
Which, it makes sense, because these are NSA agents. When you have even a lick of seniority, you're not going to be the asshole who has to run around in the streets chasing Jason Lee around. So
yeah, exactly. And this is Jason Lee in between Kevin Smith movies, so, you know, I'm sure he got a nice fat payday from his probably 2 or 3 days working on this film. Especially
between Banky and Azrael, or?
Yes, yes. Okay. But yeah, so then the hunt is on for Jason Lee's videotape of this incident, which falls into the hands of a union lawyer played by Will Smith. And Will Smith is introduced harassing a mob boss for, like, incriminating videotapes, correct?
Yes. The mob boss is threatening some people for a union vote thing, and he has a video that's showing the mob guy doing something he totally agreed not to do no more in order to not be in prison forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think they call it violating parole.
Yeah, something like that.
But basically all this shit is kind of like the first 5 minutes of a Simpsons episode where it only, it tangentially leads into what's really going on.
Right. It's almost like a the opening of a James Bond framework. It doesn't really matter.
Until it does, but 5 minutes when it does again.
Except it kind of does at the very end. Right.
Right. I mean, this is the most literal case of like Chekhov's gun I think I've ever seen. Well, I guess it's not really a gun, is it?
Chekhov's death threat?
I mean, it's Chekhov's videotape, really.
Right.
But,
So the NSA agents start figure out, because with all their goofy tracking shit, they have all kinds of, like, they're, like, tapping into, like, live cameras off of satellites, like, every single phone conversation. They do, like, weird wireframe shit from buildings. It's stuff that it's, like, because it's the NSA and not Jeff Goldblum or characters from the movie Hackers, you're just like, okay, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Is like, yeah, if anyone could do this, the fucking government could, you know?
Yeah, like with infinite resources at their disposal, sure, okay.
Yeah, like I'll buy that the surveillance state is that much. Not really 1998, but still.
Right. That's the only thing that's far fetched is that this is going on in 1998. If this movie were set later, would be a little bit more believable, I guess.
Oh yeah, if this was set in like 2004, you just look at it like this is a documentary.
Yeah, that's really the whole kit and caboodle of this, isn't it? Like,
yeah, like it's not that far removed from like 24 or something like that, you know?
Yeah,
just like a few short years later. Not only did like the entire like global political structure just completely collapse, but also, you know, the internet changed by leaps and bounds.
Did you guys notice that the Big Bad's birthday is 9/11? What's up, Super World?
I did notice that. 9/11, 1940, but still, like, holy wow.
Gosh. Little too on the nose there. Random chance.
What did Tony Scott know? Tony Scott's been talking to Biggie.
What did he know and when did he know it? Unfortunately, we'll never know. R.I.P. Tony Scott. But yeah, so the NSA, you would think that the NSA would be just like populated by, you know, the best and brightest, like athletes, athletic kind of dudes. And you get a couple of those. You get Jake Busey, you get Scott Kahn, but then you get all the tech nerds and it's like, it's Jack Black, it's Jamie Kennedy, it's Seth Green. It's a murderer's row of just like late 90s that guys.
I spent the entire movie thinking that the character played by Jack Black was played by a Jack Black lookalike, and then I got to the credits, I was like, oh, no, wait, that was actually Jack Black.
Yeah.
20 years will do that, I suppose.
Yeah, pretty much. But it runs him through, like, all of this, you know, they've, you know, frozen his credit cards, planted shit about him, bugged his house, all of the shit, just to put him on the run. They realize that he has the tape now. From Jason Lee.
Well, yeah, well, hang on, because like Jason Lee plants it on him while he is lingerie shopping for his wife, because guess what? It is, in fact, almost Christmas Day.
Hey, there it is.
And there he was, in just another line.
Christmas shoes.
Sir, I want to buy this bra. It's for my mom, you see. It's Christmas Eve and it's just her size. Kid, get the fuck out of here.
I'm sorry. Oh. I didn't expect a Christmas shoes joke to come out in like a Victoria's Secret setting.
It's like, she's not too twirled. I want mom to look really, really good if she meets Jesus tonight. You know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about like third and fourth comings over here, man.
That's it. I'm done.
Good night, everybody. Brilliant.
But yeah, folks, that's why we're talking about this movie, because this movie takes place around the holidays. There's Christmas displays everywhere.
Someone that's put all a the fucking excuse. Reindeer on an Italian restaurant, so we're watching it.
Yep, that's all the excuse we need, man. Like, hey, yo, put Bob on the tally on the roof. Vosk, you know, that's all we need. But Jason Lee, yeah, he plants this on Will Smith and then is immediately on the run from the NSA. And you think he's going to get away because he's on a bicycle and he's weaving in and out of traffic. And, oh, man, he's home free, right?
You thought wrong. The fire truck had different plans.
He is turned into a splat on the pavement faster than you can say Jason Lee. It's horrendous. This is only the start of Will Smith's problems, folks.
Yeah.
Because,
On top of this, we have, Lisa Bonet playing Rachel?
Lisa Bonet is Will Smith's informant, I guess, or she's the liaison to his informant.
His ex-girlfriend and, his contact with the person who's supplying him with pretty damn good information, a guy named Brill.
Mm-hmm.
So that he ends up all the time while being we're watching this through the NSA's cameras, mostly a lot of the stuff happening because they're, they have 30 agents following them. They got guys in fucking vans. They got guys on satellites, all this shit. Speaking of which, also just as another thing of I wonder if that'll come up later. One of the mob guys takes pains to point out that the FBI is watching the restaurant.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
and of course the FBI catches Will Smith. You know, he's involved with them somehow. They don't know what he's doing, but there he is.
Yeah. All right, so this movie is actually pretty well scripted in terms of being tight. It's just Brad's computer dies a bunch, and that's why it sounds disjointed when we're talking about it. Maybe the NSA can patch all this together for us. So this movie, it's like a little over 2 hours, this movie. It takes about an hour, right, for Gene Hackman to even fucking show up, and he's second build.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But he eventually finally shows up after Will Smith spends quite a bit of time, dodging the NSA and accidentally most of the time because he's totally getting fucking duped by them. Hackman shows up, who it turns out he's Brill. He's Lisa Bonet's
adoptive father.
We found out later he is her, I'm trying to think of a word for it, because he's not an informant. He's her detective, I guess.
Investigator,
that's the word I'm looking for.
He's her sense, source. Yeah. He's her source.
Yes,
I guess, right. Source. Say. So here's the thing about this movie. As you mentioned, it's a good hour and a half before Will Smith figures out that the NSA is messing with him.
Right.
And then we only have 60-odd minutes, less than 60 minutes left in this movie. So once the pieces fall into place for Bobby Dean, the movie really picks up. As far as the front half is kind of a slow burn, but the back half, action packed.
Yeah, the front half too is kind. I don't want to say miserable, but it is very distressing because you are just watching the NSA systematically ruin this guy's life for doing something that we know he didn't do.
Yeah,
it's one
of the better Will Smith performances. The weakest part of it is when he's just doing I'm cool type of jokes with his wife, because that's always, in my opinion, Will Smith at his weakest. He's good when he's, doing action movie shit. It's just when he gets a little too self-aware and starts, basically smirking at the camera, you just...
When he goes back into Fresh Prince mode, basically.
Maybe.
When he knows he's being, the coolest kid in the room. Yeah, pretty much. But then, at a certain point, the NSA... threatens to go after his wife and his children, and then Will Smith pipes up and says and tells them in no uncertain terms to keep his wife's name out of their goddamn mouths.
There it is.
You knew we were gonna touch that poop tonight, didn't you?
Well, that's why we did this movie, right?
Partially. There were a couple of reasons we did it. Partly because, Will Smith's in the news again. Partly because it's a summer action movie. And partly because, honestly... we really, really wanted to get Seth Green into the Triple Threat Club.
Because somebody else is in the news for a much funnier reason.
Oh, that's right. The Triple Threat Club is just the dessert, if you will, but the main course.
Yeah, there's another club that Seth Green is not in anymore, so I guess this Triple Threat Club is his consolation prize.
Is Seth Green doing cameos in order to raise enough money to get his ape back? Is that...
let's have a look-see, shall we?
Can we get a cameo from Seth Green and make him reference his stolen ape?
Say it ain't so. Where'd my ape go?
Turn the lights off.
Send me cameos.
Send me cameos.
No, I don't see Seth Green on Cameo. That's a shame.
What a shame.
That's a real bummer.
For those of you that are not internet poisoned like us, Seth Green owned a horrible JPEG of a simian, and he was going to use it to create an animated show. This is a certificate on the blockchain that says you own a piece of art, also known as an NFT.
Yeah.
And he was fished, and the ape got stolen, the very same one that he intended to make into a media property. And according to certain legal minds, he can't move forward with it when he doesn't own it.
NFTs are basically fucking bearer bonds, so I wonder why we stopped using bearer bonds.
Yeah. Well, you know what's going to happen. Real talk. It's hilarious that this happened, but he's just going to buy some other shitty bored ape and then just force the animators to crunch and replace the one that got stolen with whatever one that he gets, right?
This is like a long con, like shitty Sonic, where it's like he has a terrible ape first. He's like, oh, I got fish. I lost my ape. And then someone gives him a better ape.
That might be it.
Pretty much. But also, like, this got to the point where there's a trailer out there for this show. They've already produced parts of it. They're that far along in production, and then this happened.
It looks so bad.
It like, does. It's
all
of the humor and wit out of BoJack Horseman, you get like a Bored Ape NFT show. It sounds like a joke from BoJack Horseman, to be honest.
Wait, were folks from BoJack involved in this? Please tell me no.
No, I don't think so. I'm just saying, like, that's very much the vibe that I get off of the show itself.
Oh, depressed cartoons, basically?
Basically, yeah, yeah.
But in this case, Roger Rabbit style?
Like, oh it's a bored ape that works as a bartender, and also there's people that hang around. Like,
and then other people's shitty NFTs are patrons. Who's this for?
Hey, Brad and Joe, I would like to sincerely recommend that you both play Final Fantasy XIV online instead of watching trailers for Seth Green's monkey show. It's honestly a better worth use of your time and money.
Well, I did quit Twitter last month. And
yeah, same.
It's really been a good thing that I'm glad I did, even if Muskie isn't going to end up owning it.
And, well, you know, I'm seriously considering killing my Twitter tonight because Twitter did something to me that is kind of unforgivable, and I'm still mad about it.
What do they do?
You know how you'll randomly see, like, oh, if you're interested in this, here's a tweet based on that.
Oh no, these are always the worst. They're so insulting.
The subject was Better Call Saul. Oh yeah, I'm interested in Better Call Saul. The new season's out, and I'm looking forward to catching up with it. The account, Better Call Saul spoilers, and the post, oh, you better believe it was a Better Call Saul spoiler that I cannot unsee.
No, dear.
Great job, Twitter. You done did it.
Thanks a lot, Twitter.
The only thing mine ever recommended was Paul F. Tompkins. I'm serious. Just based on your interest, in the category Paul F. Tompkins.
I mean, he's okay, I guess.
Yeah, he's fine, but it's just like he's also a category on Twitter, apparently. Good job, Paul.
That's all you must be interested in. Also, to answer the question from several minutes ago, the only two actors that I can find on Cameo that were in this movie, mm-hmm. we can get cameos from Jake Busey and Jamie Kennedy. Jamie Kennedy plays one of the tech NSA guys, and Jake Busey plays one of the field operatives.
One of the meatheads. One of the boys.
One of the boyos.
Is he the one with the shittier haircut?
He's the one who gets the black eye later in the movie, right? The Shiner?
No, I don't know who that guy is.
Oh, okay.
So there's one that has just a fucking like crew cut, and there's one that has some like dipshit head that makes him look like a fucking matchstick that's on fire.
I think that's Scott Kahn.
Okay.
That's the one that wound up being in all of the Ocean's 11 movies. But anyway, Jake Busey. We could get a cameo from this guy for $69.
Nice.
Or if we wanted to shell out for a business cameo, it's $5,000.
I'm really sad that we never got a Gilbert Gottfried Santa cameo.
Oh, me too, man. That's such a bummer.
We really should have. What were we thinking?
But so getting back,
should have spent more of Joe's money. We're kind of meandering because a lot of this movie is just action scenes, and it's hard to really describe them without getting ultra granular. And who wants that?
Will Smith runs somewhere, stops long enough to get a plot point, and then he has to run somewhere again.
Yeah. He stops long enough. He loses the NSA, and then gets a plot dump, and then, or like a lore dump, essentially.
Takes a plot dump.
But they're basically catching him up on the plot that we already know due to the magic of dramatic tension. And by the time we have 60 minutes left in this movie, he actually knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decide to go, okay, well, I'm getting ahead of myself.
You mentioned how it takes, you know, a good hour and a half for this movie to wind up, and then it just completely, like, solves everything in the last half hour, which I think that's also a pretty good metaphor for, like, the general ability of, like, U.S. intelligence / military of just, like, hey, we didn't know these guys could fight back. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Or just any, like, government investigation ever. You know, you get the wind-up and the build-up and the build-up, and, oh, they're going to release something soon, and, oh, we're going to find out, and then nothing happens.
Or the government anything. Doesn't have to be military. Doesn't have to be intelligence. Let me tell ya.
Oh, yeah. But one of the things that we haven't really gotten to yet, and I know Bradford might have some insight into this. Do we want to even talk about this?
What do I have insight into?
The geography.
Oh, yeah. There's some minor gaffes that are made, geographically speaking, for the sake of pacing. Although the only one that was actually a standout, I originally thought this movie got teleported to Baltimore, but they were still trying to pretend it was DC, but later they started using Baltimore addresses and saying they're in Baltimore, so okay, that's fine.
They did teleport to Baltimore, and then they just committed to the bit.
Yeah.
Well, they took a ferry, Jesus.
The only real goof is that Occoquan Park is in Virginia, and it's pretty far south of DC. It's not in Maryland, and it's not close to DC, but hey.
So it's like not on the Fallout 3 map at all?
Yeah, it would be south of the Fallout 3 map, I would say.
That's literally my only reference for DC geography, is if it's on the Fallout 3 map or not.
Is Quantico on the Fallout 3 map?
Probably not.
I don't think
it's
so.
South of Occoquan's like near Quantico. It's like south of Quantico. It's like down where the traffic gets really bad. Anyways.
Yeah.
No, people know I'm from the DC area. That's fine. Yeah, everything else is pretty spot on once they admit that they're in Baltimore. At first I thought they were trying to pretend the ferry's in DC, but nah. Or that DC is near the ocean at all, which it's not.
I mean, right, like
kind of is relative to the UNESCO, the United States. Sure, it's very close to the ocean, but
that's really the only
drive.
Really, the only primary cheat is that they take the ferry from DC to Baltimore when, you know, there's really no way to do that.
Yeah, because you'd have to go all the way around Delmarva. It would take so long to do that.
Yeah,
I think they filmed on a ferry that just goes between different ports of different parts of the harbor in Baltimore. I don't think they really suggested that Bobby was going on a ferry from DC to Baltimore, because that would be literally the dumbest idea ever.
And
it'd be like a 12-hour ferry at ferry speeds.
It would also kind of make sense though, because like the purpose of the ferry is that it's like the intel drop point from between Banks and Brill, right?
Yeah, but so, it's,
I don't know.
It just doesn't make sense as a ferry, is all I'm saying.
That's fine.
You could probably bike to Baltimore faster than you could take a ferry to Baltimore from DC.
Tell that to Jason Lee.
All right, I got some important information. So, basically the south end of the Fallout 3 map is the Jefferson Memorial.
Oh, right. Yeah. No right. way. Yeah. It's way south of there.
So what were we talking about? Fallout 3?
We're talking about Fallout 3.
We were getting mired in the logistical business of commuter transportation, like we do a lot on this show, I think.
I think transit comes up a lot. Games come up a lot, like Fallout 3, and also the fact that the drop, did we mention, the video is stored on a Who card plugged into a Turbo Express for some reason.
An NEC now, Turbo Express.
Now, they've covered up the Turbo Express logo with just an NEC sticker, but the point remains that they have all of this government-sensitive video is on a glorified Game Boy.
No, it's on a glorified Sega Nomad.
Yes, I know. Thank you. I was trying to simplify it for those who listen who don't know things about video games.
For the non-turbo nerds out there.
For the uninitiated, there was a system released by NEC in the 90s called the TurboGrafx-16. Highly underrated system. But a little bit later, they came out with a handheld version called the Turbo Express, which basically played the same games except in a mobile format, which was really cool. But it was also incredibly expensive for the time. It was $300 at the time. Oof. And that was before you adjusted for inflation.
Wow.
Yes. But anyways.
Yeah, when you get a Game Boy for less than $100.
Correct.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But then Dean's kid gets a hold of the device, and when he confronts him about it and asks for it back, the kid was like, oh yeah, it didn't work anyways. It just, like, we turned it on and it would just, the screen would glitch, and that was about it, because the cartridge that's in the slot is not a TurboGrafx game. It's a fucking murder tape.
It's a jazz drive.
Yeah.
I thought the reason it was scrambled is because it was encrypted.
I guess you could see it that way. I just assumed that he jammed it into the console as a carrying device.
Well, Who cards? Oh God, I'm such a nerd. Okay. Like, the only thing close to the shape and size of a Who card, they're basically like almost the size of a credit card. That's their whole thing, was the form factor was very thin.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that would be close to it, you guys remember Zip Drive? You remember Zip Discs?
Oh, yeah.
Talking about Jazz Drive, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much the only thing comparable would be a Zip Disc, but I don't even think it would fit in. Because those Who cards are like just a couple of millimeters wide. They're pretty thin. Mm-hmm. So I think they were trying to play up the Who cards as like this weird future format, I guess. But when they got to the safe house, which we'll get into, for whatever reason, our guy Brill could read the Who card no problem. So I don't know, man. Whatever.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Like, I'm not gonna look too hard into that one, because like, I get it's, they picked a weird device that most people wouldn't know about, and they picked a weird like cartridge format that most people wouldn't know about, and to like the untrained eye, yeah, it's futuristic and weird and okay, whatever, fine. But I still think it's interesting, and like my dumb brain just resorted to like, oh yeah, he jammed the disc into this Game Boy and then the Game Boy didn't work because it's not the right kind of cartridge.
But like, he was on the run from the NSA or coming to murk him. Why would he jam it into a Turbo Express before he got going,
when you've only got 5 seconds, like any port in a storm?
I get any literal port in a store. So
mean,
here's the,
maybe
here's,
he was
maybe,
planning ahead. Maybe he was planning ahead of just like, they're looking for a disc. They're not looking for a fucking
Game Boy.
NEC Turbo Express. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's the weirdest thing about this, the whole thing, is that the Turbo Express came out almost 8 years before this movie came out. So it's not product placement. They've covered up the name Turbo Express with an NEC sticker.
Yeah, so something I read on trivia was that like, they explicitly picked this because they wanted like a game system, but they wanted something that looked weird.
Okay, well, that definitely fits the bill.
Yeah,
I'm sure that most people in the U.S. are not even familiar with the Turbo Express. Whereas, you know, the Game Gear is not a good choice, and the Game Boy is far too iconic. So, like, this is pretty much it.
And the Nomad is just unrealistic, because, come on.
Who the fuck has that many batteries?
Exactly. I mean, this is 1998. This is the height of, like, you know, disposable tech. Will Smith could be carting around a whole slew of just rechargeable double A's. You don't know. Boy, that's a non-starter. Anyway.
All right. So, yeah, they go to the safe house. They look at the video. They realize what it is. I love the safe house because it's basically my house. You go inside it and you don't get any fucking phone signal.
A Faraday cage with a bunch of cats?
Yeah. Like a lighthouse.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, there's just a cat that is, like, actually the person who runs the roost, and then, like, yeah, your phone don't fucking work inside. Yeah, in my house, it's not actually, I don't think they meant to make a Faraday cage. I think it was built by guys in the 40s that normally built, like, commercial buildings. So they did the same thing they did in those, which was you put some, like, wire latticing up and smear plaster over it to make the walls.
There you go.
Oh.
Yeah, so I have to buy, like, I had to, back when we had COVID bucks, you know, come in, I had to buy, like, a fucking $200+ router to even get something that covers the entire fucking house, just because you go around the corner and just, you lose signal unless the router's already bouncing shit around everywhere.
Oh, jeez.
This fucker has, like, three antennas on and some shit, and we even have, like, got it, there's even a fucking repeater in the, this house is less than 1,000 square feet, we have a fucking repeater in the bedroom just to have signal in there. I swear to God.
That's intense, dude.
Yeah. Well, whatever. Don't gotta pay for it. So
hey, as long as it works, yeah. Right? But also, what the fuck is his name?
Will Smith.
Brill. I was like, is his name Blink? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, Blink. Yeah, he's running down the street naked. But yeah, there's lots of things. Like, the only reason they even find him is because Will Smith makes a phone call on a payphone, and they're already looking for his voice signature or whatever techno wizardy bullshit you want to do.
I think they tapped all of his contacts, and he called his secretary or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, if he had called some random number, they wouldn't have known, but he called his secretary and tipped them off, and then they traced the call. And then they also ID'd Brill from the convenience store camera.
Which they only knew to look at because they had the phone call, yeah.
Yes.
So, smooth move, Will Smith.
Yeah, I love the exchange they have, too. It's like, what the hell? What the hell's happening? And Brill goes, I blew up the building. Why'd you do that? Because you had to make a phone call.
Womp, womp. We didn't even get into the fact that they killed What's-Her-Face.
Yeah, they killed Banks, and they tried to plant Dean's evidence. Clothes.
To plant Dean's clothes to incriminate him in her death.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
All the while that this is occurring, until, again, the last hour of the movie, Dean thinks that it's the mob doing this because he received a death threat due to his original case at the very beginning of this movie.
Yes, yes. He still has no inkling that the NSA is even a factor here.
Because he doesn't know he has, or his son has, the Turbo Express.
Because the two meathead guys, not James Caan.
Yeah, Scott Caan.
Yeah, James Caan and Gary Busey come to his door, and they're just like talking about it because he saw the accident, like he saw Danny's, Avance's, Jason Lee's character's body. So he thinks they're come to ask him about the accident, and he's just like, no, he was in some extortion scheme, is what the story they cook up, and asked her to ask about it. And the problem is that you can't really, like, strong arm a lawyer about, like, with cop shit usually.
Yeah,
like they're the ones who will tell you to fuck off.
Wasn't one of the guys in the van like, dang, this guy's good. Yeah, he's a lawyer. Come
he's
on.
Not stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I think he was more like laughing and just like, ah. Like he's just laughing. I think it's just one of those things where he's laughing at the fucking, like, beatheads just being like,
thinking they're going to get one over on a lawyer.
Yeah.
There is a fun little running gag where Will Smith is a big fan of blended juice, and they ransack his, like, the meatheads ransack his house and install a bunch of bugs, and they don't steal anything except for the blender, and then throughout the rest of the movie, the guys in the van are just drinking blended juice using his blender. It's pretty good.
But yeah, so all of this comes together. He realizes that they're looking for something that was in his bags, and when he realizes that, oh, the kid must have looked through the Christmas presents and taken it, and then, yeah, he actually did, and he gives him the machine. That's when they hooks back up with Brill, uses the dead drop, which is like pretty standard like Spycraft type shit. Like it's pretty spot on for what an actual like, you know, agent would do.
Right.
So that's, you know, the movie did its research in a lot of ways, I think.
How would you know this, Jonathan Five?
I've killed a lot of spies. You fucking come into the goddamn house. You know, what am I supposed to do?
There's actually a pretty fun scene when he first tries to make contact with Brill, where it's actually, no, it's just the NSA. And he fucked it up.
Yeah, it's David Byrne.
Yeah. So it's the NSA basically staking out. What?
It's not David Byrne from the Talking Heads. It's the guy from Miller's Crossing.
Anyways, he messes up and he basically thinks that an NSA agent is Brill. And so it's all compromised, but Brill ends up rescuing him and giving him sort of a download on what's going on.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Before saying, come back to me and I'll kill you.
Yeah, and then one of the neat things is the fake Brill pulls a bug out of his left shoe, which of course he has a bug in his right shoe as well, and also in his watch, and his phone, and his pager, his pen. They've also put them in his clothes. And it's the thing they keep mentioning, like, you know, there's the bugs they want you to find so that you think you found them all.
And that we could get back to that in a very little bit. So we're kind of jumping around here a little bit. So let me increase the speed here a little bit. So yeah. he finds the Turbo Express and he takes it to Brill, who is able to decrypt it, and they figure out why the NSA is after them. They have this murder of this congressman on tape. But during the ensuing chase, Brill's car catches on fire and Dean's jacket catches on fire and the disc is in there. So it destroys the disc. So they've lost their leverage. However,
this fucking cat is still just hanging out in like a...
in a bag.
In a duffel bag.
So at this point, they've lost their leverage. However, they're kind of out for revenge because they've compromised Brill's safe house and they've ruined Dean's life. And so now everything is out in the open as far as our protagonist is concerned. And now they know
who exactly it is doing it to them. Like, they know it's John Voight.
Yeah, and why. So, oh, that's right. They do kind of like a backwards check because it turns out Brill was originally working for the NSA. But he left.
That's how he knows, you know, that they're watching everybody. How he knows what to do about all this stuff.
Yes. So they pull all of the bugs out of Dean's sort of kit, and they decide to use these to their advantage. And so they end up finding a guy who's on cable news talking about this surveillance bill, and they decide to break into his hotel room and intentionally sort of obviously place all of these bugs so that the military gets involved, because John Voight, also known as the character's name is Thomas, he's been doing this sort of all to advance his own personal agenda and, you know, get a promotion. He's been doing this all behind the back of the military and the FBI. He's cut through all of the red tape and gone without authorization to do any of this.
So they plant all these bugs in a fucking congressman's room, and the congressman, of course, starts finding them. And yeah, that's just like turning it around. They start like fucking with Reynolds's credit cards, and they have his job after him because it's just like, there's like, who the fuck like took company property for this fucking operation that I'm sure has a perfectly good reason, otherwise you wouldn't be fucking doing it type thing.
Yeah.
So this all leads up to sort of the final confrontation, or the final two sets of confrontations, where Brill comes to Thomas Reynolds. Thank you, notes. I did a note.
He got it in like one.
A minute ago.
I got it in one. I remembered a character's name. He goes to Reynolds and he says, all right, I got the tape. Let's make an exchange. All the while, Dean is sort of looking on
and recording. They're trying to get him to mention like killing somebody on they tape. They don't have the tape anymore, but if they can get him to start talking about it, then they're taping that.
Right.
And he has like a 4-minute countdown. He's like, you have 4 minutes before they actually start tracing you and all this shit. And but Reynolds is still a spy himself, so he manages to spend long enough time just rattling on about what the fuck ever. Like, he just basically just giving statements. Rumsfeld's fucking, like, known unknowns speech, pretty much.
And then all of his goons are around, too. So, Reynolds is behind a fence. Or not Reynolds, sorry. Brill is behind a fence. But he's got a wire on him, but they don't activate it until later. I said, if we broke down every scene like this, we'd be here. Yeah. Like, all of the scenes play out like this.
Yeah, suffice to say, the goons catch Will Smith, and then they catch Brill later on. They put them both in the van.
But Brill tries to sell out he tries to get, like, a retirement package. And I don't know if that was I'm still trying to figure out if that was intentional or not for the second part of this
scene. I think what was happening is that was his... I read that as his cover for like why he was involved in this. Like,
yeah,
he didn't want to give off that he was actually like personally involved, like because you fucking killed, you know,
because he has a vendetta because he killed his adoptive daughter.
Yeah. So if he just makes it seem like he's just holding a grudge because of the old days or whatever,
So they grab Brill and Dean and they shove him in a van. And they're like, okay, he's like, we don't have the tape with us. And they're like, where's the tape? And he gives them the address of the Italian restaurant at the very beginning of this movie.
And
we
meet Tom Sizemore and his wife and kids having a lovely Christmas spaghetti dinner.
His son, Augustus Gloop, and his other son, Augustus Gloop. The two roundest fucking kids ever. Like, these are like Mike Huckabee's kids, like fucking, like in 1998, I think. This is the Huckabee brothers.
Tortured a dog.
Like, not for nothing, but like even in like this situation, like if my dad insisted on having every one of our meals in the kitchen of the restaurant that we owned, I would have some serious questions for him.
Watching horse racing.
Yeah, it's just such a strange setup. Like, I get that it's a mafia thing, but like these kids must be miserable.
Yeah, because you know what the dad's doing is like, if I stay in my restaurant where everybody has a fucking gun, then I don't get arrested again. Perfect. It's like, well, family, guess what? We're all staying in the restaurant, so you don't get arrested either.
It's a camp out.
Yeah, kids, we're camping out in daddy's restaurant for the rest of our lives.
That's about the size of it, jeez. But yeah, so then Dean plays his gambit where he basically tries to get Reynolds to accuse the mob guy of having the tape. The mob guy has no fucking clue what he's talking about, so he just owns up to it because he thinks Will Smith is talking about the original tape from the start of the film. It's like, yeah, I got the tape, not giving it to you. And
meanwhile, the FBI guys are all going about, like, you know, phoning everybody they can, trying to get their fucking, like, go-ahead to go in, because they're still doing shit by the fucking book.
Right.
I love the cutaways, the FBI guys basically trying to get somebody to fucking sign a warrant, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
It was just great. All this, like, tense gun standing off in the back of the FBI guys on the phone being like, no, can we go in yet? Please?
Pretty please? With a cherry on top. Yeah, there's a scene. Brill is still in the van with the other guys and Jack Black. Oh, by the way, while they're en route to the Italian restaurant, Reynolds, thank you, notes, Reynolds fesses up to the entire thing, but Jack Black and the other sort of tech guys record it, I guess, so that they, if the things break bad, they kind of have leverage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I think that was their like, look, I'm cooperating card for later, more or less.
Yes.
And that was one thing that I noted, kind of charted throughout the entire film, is that, like, Jack Black's character is the only one who is constantly at every turn trying to give Dean the benefit of the doubt. Like, maybe he's just some guy, you know? And no one pays him any attention.
He's sitting there always saying, like, maybe he doesn't have it, you know? Like, when they start doing, like, the weird enhanced zoom thing with a bag, he's just like, it could be a shadow, it could be something got dropped in, you know? And everyone else, like, this is absolutely tape, if that's what it has to be, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, the standoff Will Smith ducks under the table. Everybody shoots everybody.
Because which one of it is it? Is it Khan or Busey that runs in with a fucking gun?
It's Busey. Busey fucks it all up and starts shooting.
Right, because Brill kind of eggs them on. He's like, well, those are your guys. Go in, go in.
Yeah. Tries to get him out of the van. And then, it's like not just like the mob guys, but
no,
then like.
No, it's not even that. It's Busey sneaking in through the fucking kitchen is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because the fucking chef pulls a gun on him.
Yeah, like even like the chef and the line cook, they all have like shotguns and shit.
It's great. Everybody has a. It's like Scary Movie 3. Just everybody has a gun. Why not?
Yeah, of course. So like everybody in this kitchen dies except for Will Smith,
and who hides under the table, and then the FBI come in for the aftermath.
Yeah, and then we cut to a scene of like it's Jack Black in a neck brace, and I think it's Jamie Kennedy's with him, and they're just being like. They're clearly just stalling for time, and they're like hemming and hawing in their fucking confession that they're giving, more or less.
Yeah,
it's just fun. It's just funny that all of these guys are like running the same playbook that they all fucking know, because all of the shit that Gene Hackman does back to John Voight, it's like just the same shit they're doing. Like it's a 20-year-old playbook. They all know each other's shit.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Right?
Yeah.
But that's the end of the movie. Like, Will Smith, presumably his family is back together and everything's hunky dory. Brill is going to have to go find a new safe house. Apologies to Brill. And
he goes to the Brill beach is... where. He goes
oh, that's
to
right.
Beach
that's right.
The beach.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right.
He goes to the beach where Andy Frame's like building a boat or whatever.
I completely forgot about that. No, and Will Smith sees this as like an encrypted message that comes across his TV as you see a message on the sand that says "Wish you were here," and also
the picture of the cat.
Yeah, you see the Brill's cat
because this movie does save the cat, so I'll allow it.
Very intentionally so, yes. But that's Enemy of the State.
Yeah,
a movie
it's a fun watch. It's very dumb. Turn your brain off.
It's fucking exhausting, but yes, I had a good time with this one.
Yeah.
I think just the state of the world today and, you know, everything in it, it makes this a lot more stressful than it would have been like 20 some years ago.
Yeah. Because it's just like
it's your the reality gets, that we live in now, essentially.
Yeah, it's your life gets ruined, you know, because you just happen to be in the wrong store at the wrong fucking time when some other guy runs through.
Yeah. And as far as like the NSA security surveillance state goes, like, well, there's not a whole lot of disbelief to suspend anymore. So,
yeah,
it is what it is. But should we jump over to the crankometer and give this a rating?
Let's talk about a little bit more first about the movie general,
sure.
I think.
Yeah. OK,
because, yeah, it's like I say, it's a fun watch. The Christmas there's just Christmas trees in a couple scenes. There's reindeer over the Italian restaurant. You know, it's absolutely fucking window dressing, and it's a reason for him to be buying. I mean, really, the Christmas serves the plot in a way. You could have it without Christmas, but what I mean is the entire reason the kid finds the toy is because he's searching through the Christmas presents.
There's a couple of other small touches too. We have some Christmas music going on, and like the convenience store and other places.
Sure.
At one point, Reynolds says the line, "I hate doing this at Christmas."
Yeah,
there's a nod to that. And then in a fun touch, when Dean and Brill are bugging the congressman's hotel room, they put one in a Christmas ornament. That's fun.
Oh, I missed that. Yeah.
I also loved Reynolds's wife just being like, why haven't you made assistant director by now?
Well, Skyler, let me explain this to you.
Yeah. It's just like the kind of like the career like agency asshole, the kind of like who could put up with that? And it's just someone just as miserable. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Somebody who has a work desk in their bedroom, if you didn't notice.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's that one line that Reynolds gives near the end where he's like, I think he's explaining it to Brill, like what the hell they're doing. And he says like, well, we won the war and now we're fighting the peace.
Ugh, and fucking asshole.
just looking at the long arc of history since 1998 and like, boy, is that ever true.
Yeah, but I love how, like, basically any time they actually start fighting back, Brill and Dean, they immediately win just because of how fucking the government doesn't expect it, basically.
Yeah.
They don't expect to have someone fight back. They just expect they expect to just steamroll over people, basically.
Yeah, like, basically, Will Smith shoots their truck once with a shotgun and just, that's it, they're done.
Yeah.
Like it was just immediately as soon as he had a shotgun, it was just like, oh, well, the chase is over, I win.
Exactly.
And yeah, like they immediately do all the shit back to Reynolds that he's doing to them, and it's just he doesn't have an answer for it because like they don't know how to fucking undo it. They never had to.
we've never been put in this situation before. Maybe you should have been at least once during your field training.
Voight, when there's this sort of turnaround situation, he does the best like geriatric confused man. Like, the anger behind his pallid face is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like, the payoff is very good.
Yeah, I'm just imagining just like, hey, Sarge, they threw the grenade back. What do I do?
And two, like, I think at this point, Voight had just done the first Mission Impossible movie where he was the villain. So I think he was still very much like in that mindset, like as far as characters go. So he's honestly as terrible as John Voight usually is nowadays. He's pretty good in this. He's a good villain. Phelps. Yeah, he was Phelps in Mission Impossible. Okay.
Yeah, I overall liked this movie for what it was. I can go to Crank Armor now. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the last thing I'll say is like the style of it is something that I kind of miss. Like I realized I missed while we were watching this, like just the style of a late 90s like action movie.
Yeah, I love this, like it's not shooting for any higher than a fucking like B rating action movie, basically. Not like a B movie, but as in like it doesn't need to be good, really. It just needs to hold your attention for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. And to its credit, is not trying to tie in for a sequel or a cinematic universe.
And also, it's just over 2 hours, which, like I've said before about movies, like, if you're in an action movie, I'll give you 2 hours, but as soon as you hit that 2 hour mark, what are you doing?
Yep. Yeah. At least just, in this case, they're wrapping shit up at that point.
Yeah.
Let an action movie be its own thing. Stand alone. Don't try to make it a thing.
And not to mention that, but also, like, it's just nice to see an actual car chase for once and like things that are actually on fire and they're not just CG flames on a wireframe hood. Like it's just the tactile sense of like, oh yeah, Will Smith really is running away from that car right now. It's just,
yeah.
Practical effects,
I mean, all the way, man.
I mean, yeah. Like speaking of Tony Scott, it's why Tom Cruise actually has like a career that I kind of respect now versus Tom Cruise and like anything before Mission Impossible.
That's true, yeah. And I mean, we've encountered Tony Scott before on the podcast. We did The Last Boy Scout. Was it last year, I think, we did that one?
Two years ago.
God.
I think. Don't quote me on that.
Like I said, man, staring down infinity right now.
Speaking of staring down infinity, and speaking of action movies and cinematic universes.
Oh, no.
Are we ever going to make it back to this kind of action movie, or is this a relic of the past?
I mean, I think these movies are dead because everything has to be. You can't make a movie that just does well anymore. It's just, no, we were promised the line would keep going up forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this would be considered like a mid-budget action movie for adults. That's they don't make those movies anymore, you know? No. They just don't.
Are they ever going to stop making Marvel movies, do you think, until the heat death of the universe or the apocalypse?
I think if COVID couldn't derail that train, I don't think anything will.
It could if they sucked, and they sucked consistently for like 3 or 4 movies in a row and really sucked. But then all they would do is they'd wait 2 or 3 years and then try to start it up again.
Yeah.
Well, see, even in that instance, like they're kind of pivoting away from that, and they're putting all their eggs into the streaming TV basket. So they can kind of get away with not trying as hard because, well, it's just a TV show. What do you expect?
I miss movies, guys.
I watched a Marvel movie recently. We've seen two movies in theaters in the last month, which is two more than we've seen in the last 2 years.
It's still, to this day, I've said it before on you, the last movie I saw in the theater was Force Awakens.
Wow.
That's impressive.
That is impressive and also really depressing. We went and saw Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was fantastic. And I'm so glad we watched it in theaters.
Mm-hmm. That's a good, that's such a fun one.
Oh, it's manic. It's so good.
If we started talking about it, we would probably never end this podcast.
Yeah. We gotta, but the reason I bring up Marvel is because we were out another day and we didn't want to go home. And we were just like, what do we do? And we were like, let's go watch a movie. And lo and behold, what is the only movie that we have a decent time frame for that we're at least remotely interested? Why, it's Doctor Strange 2.
Oh, no.
So we go and watch Doctor Strange 2. And it's fine. But for like the first third of the movie, we have no idea what the hell anybody's talking about. Because it's all tied in to the greater Marvel Cinematic Universe, which neither of us have seen. These movies are inscrutable to anybody who isn't like, hasn't seen everything. Like, I had to explain the concept of WandaVision during the movie, and I haven't seen it, just through cultural osmosis.
That's the problem with Doctor Strange 2. It's not a sequel to Doctor Strange, it's a sequel to WandaVision.
I know, right? And I haven't seen WandaVision. At least I'm like somewhat familiar with the premise, but my wife is sitting there like, okay, who's this Scarlet Witch person? But
and not to mention, like, there's just the structure of that movie. And Jonathan, I'm sorry, we're just going to be blabbing about Doctor Strange now for a minute. Like, that movie starts with Doctor Strange running away from a giant noodly space monster. And then in the very next scene, he has to fight another giant noodly space monster. And it's like, well, where do you go from there? you can only go down from that kind of an opener.
Yeah, you're kind of right.
It's like you start at the third act and you work backwards. Like, no, you can't do that.
It wasn't very good. It was fine.
Like, I love that Sam Raimi gets work. That's about where my respect for that movie ends.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's not belabor of the point. Doctor Strange 2 is not great. Enemy of the State was a good time, though. So let's jump over to the Crankometer, and we'll rate this feature film and be about our way. The Crankometer, folks, is our patented XY-axis for rating Christmas movies. The X-axis is our Christmas quotient, how Christmassy a film is. And the Y-axis is the quality quotient, which is, you know, how good or bad the film is. So, gentle friends, X-axis, how Christmassy is Enemy of the State?
So, Doctor Strange is that movie with, like, Glinda Witch Poppy Patch in it, right? Joe heard it.
I just sighed twice, and I had to point that out. I sighed, and then I sighed again when you asked how Christmassy this movie was.
It's not particularly.
There are plot things that happen that are kind of, sort of, tangentially related to Christmas. Maybe? But it could have very well been birthday presents. Exactly. I don't know.
Here's my feeling is, it's not particularly Christmassy at all, but I'm not going to hold that against it.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't see it as a negative that this movie is not Christmassy, because if we started going by that metric, well, then, like, 9/10 of every film out there is going to get a negative on that ratio. But
I'm kind of glad it's there.
Yeah, I mean, I want to save negative for movies that basically are just like, no, you're doing Christmas the wrong way, you fucking heathens.
Yeah,
and it's just like, don't fucking preach to me.
I think Shane Black's
don't
on
preach to
something.
Me, Christian movie.
I think Shane Black is onto something, and it's nice to have like action movies set around Christmas. The lights look nice. It's kind of nice to have a Christmas tree in the corner of a scene just because.
if it's Christmas out, that means it's cold and you can have a main character run around the streets in a big trench coat that flops all over the place.
It's just turtleneck.
It's just dynamic to see these things on screen, and it's cinematography and it's fine. Honestly, I'm just going to give this a one because like it's there and I respect it, but it's giving it more than that feels like cheating.
Yes, a one. That was what I was thinking too.
I like the amount it uses it to, which is it's not just one fucking scene like Cobra. It we see decorations quite all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
It doesn't hit you. It doesn't hit you over the head with it like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where it uses Christmas music and fight scenes. You know.
Yeah, or just it's just an excuse to get some scantily clad ladies in Christmas lingerie, which, you know, not bad either, but still, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I get that. So then, yeah, quality quotient. How good is this? How much did we enjoy it? I feel like we all enjoyed this a fair amount.
I did.
I'm, you know me, I will totally sit down and watch a stupid 90s action movie and just, like, be entertained.
Is this just us being old? That we like the sight and sound of a 90s action movie.
Well, it's more because like what you said, where it's like this movie is self-contained. It doesn't have a sequel set up that like absolutely like, you know. I'll even allow a sequel set up that's just like here we go again. You know, it's annoying, but I'll allow it.
I almost respect the sequels that kind of ham-fistedly make a sequel when the first one does really good numbers, rather than like having a scene set up at the very end of the first movie hoping for a sequel, you know what I mean? Where the villain wakes up again, or the two protagonists are standing on a hillside and then a helicopter comes up over the horizon or something. Yeah. And then they cut to black. Like,
so yeah, so let's, I don't want to actually spoil the video game because I wish people should play it. But I bought this game called Eternal Threads because it looked like extremely my fucking shit. And it ends with a blatant sequel hook, and now I just have to hope that they actually get enough sales to make a fucking sequel, so I look like, now I'm just going to be disappointed if it doesn't, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I think we're old. I think we're old. I'm sure we have, maybe we have some Zoomer listeners. If you were born after the year 2000... Have you seen a 90s action movie, and do you get down with that aesthetic, or well, are you just old?
It's not even that for me as much as it's just like, yeah, it's like you said, now it's like now movies have to be all or nothing. It's either like just absolute indie, what the fuck ever is going on, or it's if this movie makes less than $1 billion, it's a fucking failure.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no chance to like make a movie for like, one or two $100 million, and then you make $400 million. And it's like, well, we did what you came here to do.
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, play it on fucking FX like 20 times a day for a week.
Yeah, I mean, we're on our what, like fifth or sixth like direct to DVD Jarhead sequel. But
are you fucking kidding me?
No,
really?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, the things that kind of short circuit this are basically pandering, more or less.
Yeah,
like pander to the troops, pander to the fucking basically pander to conservatives of any stripe, more or less. That's how you get the sequel factory going.
Yeah,
I would have never guessed that there was a direct to DVD Jarhead series in the vein of like Disney princesses, but here we are.
I mean, isn't there one for The Substitute as well?
Probably, I guess. But like, yes. you know, Jarhead, the movie about the first Iraq war, that's about how boring and kind of anticlimactic the first Iraq war was. Yeah, they made three sequels.
Good Lord.
Jarhead 2, Field of Fire in 2014. Jarhead 3, The Siege in 2016. Jarhead Law of Return in 2019.
Jarhead Law of Return?
Law of Return, yes.
What an anime-ass title. Jeez
Louise. And we can't even get a fucking another Dread movie made.
Oh, God. Tell me about it.
Dread 2 or Crank 3. Just give me one of them, please. Good lord.
Is it,
y'all.
What does it say about us that the three of us really, there's something about Dread. I don't know. It's like the most like right-wing fantasy, but the three lefty boys here just love the shit out of it. Like, what's going on?
Because it's
campy and it's tongue-in-cheek, I guess.
Yeah, and it's nice and self-contained, and you have a character who, even though he is in Dread the Law, he's still at least trying to really focus on
the law, actually.
Yeah, and fucking with people that actually deserve it. Like, the guy at the beginning who's loitering, he's just like, get the fuck out of here before I come back, because if I come back, I gotta write you a ticket then, you know, or whatever, you know? And he's actually, like, it's kind of like why you like watching, like, fucking, like, CSI or Law and Order or something like that, because it's like, it's nice to see, like, actual, like, good characters.
The
like,
idealized version of
bad characters, yeah.
Yeah,
it's less so much the idea of, like, fantasy cops, but more the idea that fantasy cops will actually abide and uphold the law. Like, part of why we still care about RoboCop at all, is that RoboCop is all about, like, yeah, isn't it kind of shitty that cops suck and also corporations suck, too? Yeah, it sucks. But, Where were we going with this digression anyway?
I have no clue. We have lost the thread entirely. I think we were at a 1-3,
something like that. Yeah,
I'm fine with the 3. Can we bump it up to a 4? Is there any my feeling on Enemy of the State is that I appreciate a good twisty, turny conspiracy thriller thing, especially when I can. I don't like to say turn my brain off, but when it can continuously feed me the information that I need when I need it, I appreciate that.
Like, as soon as he, like, started turning the bags up and couldn't find it, I was like, I bet the kid stole it. And then I was right about that, but then I was totally blindsided by the restaurant coming back, though. I had completely fucking forgotten about the restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely no way I would have guessed that.
Yeah, same. I'm okay with a 4. I liked this a lot. Like, I enjoyed my time with this, which is not something I can say about a lot of movies that we watch.
At least we could have been watching a lot fucking worse, you know, so many ways.
Yeah, and next time we just might. So yeah, that's Enemy of the State is a positive 1, positive 4 on our crankometer. Next time on the show, I think we're pretty safe in teeing this one up. Well, let's keep this summer gravy train rolling. And we'll be discussing the 1997 summer action flick Turbulence.
Armageddon.
Why not? Oh, boy. Yeah, Turbulence, starring the dearly departed Ray Liotta. It apparently takes place on Christmas Eve. So you know what? That's all the excuse we need.
Sure.
Why not?
So... that's going to do it for Christmas Creeps. We've very much overstayed our welcome tonight. But if you want to email us anything at all, email that to us at xmascreeps@gmail.com. You can tweet at us at Christmas Creeps on Twitter. We're on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, pretty much wherever you find social media or podcasts. We are not on TikTok. And
we are not on TikTok. We are not yet on Grindr.
Never say never.
If we're gonna get on Grindr, it has to be all three of us at the same time showing up to whatever date.
I mean, so basically, if you need to find me, so you go to Final Fantasy 14 and you give a letter to the post moogle, but then you also like draw a chalk mark on the post moogle when you go there, and then you get on the airship that goes to the Gold Saucer, and you leave a letter under the bench. And then I won't answer it because I'm busy gambling in the Gold Saucer because it's the casino.
And if the guy from Cool World shows up, you know you fucked up.
Yes.
But yeah, go to your favorite podcatcher of choice and leave us a star rating and a review. Tell folks about this show because we love producing it and we want to keep producing it as long as we can. And getting the show out there helps us do that. So do all that fun stuff. Folks, thank you so much for listening to us. I've been Joseph Wade for Christmas Creeps.
I'm Bradford.
I'm Brill. Prove me wrong.
I knew it. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.